Hello, thank you for tuning in to KSMC 89.5 in Moraga. I'm Connor Hornsby.
And I'm Linda Palma, and we are your hosts for today's show. Today, we have three special segments: media representation and underrepresentation, as we consider the way that people of color and marginalized identities show up or don't show up in media.
Artivism, or the act of using books, film, theater, and stories to promote social justice.
And in our last segment, The Personal is Political, we'll hear the personal stories and struggles and triumphs related to identity, overcoming addiction, and motherhood.
According to a study by University of Southern California, across 100 top-grossing films of 2012, less than 11% of speaking characters are Black, while about 4% are Hispanic, 5% are Asian, and 3.6% are from other or mixed-race ethnicities.
Coming up in the next segment, Forrest Solis talks with Desiree Anderson about what the impact of underrepresentation and misrepresentation is as it pertains to race, class, and gender.
Desiree Anderson is the director for the Intercultural Center at St. Mary's College. Anderson says she strives for equal representation on the small Moraga campus. Anderson also says that television and other forms of media show a subtle, and not so subtle, misrepresentations of various marginalized communities, such as women, people in the LGBT community, and people of color. These misrepresentations not only affect the group itself, but the population around them. I sat down with Anderson to get her take on the problems and possible solutions of misrepresentation in the media.
My name is Desiree Anderson, and I'm the director of the Intercultural Center.
Summary of what your speech was about.
Yeah, so the title was called, Who's Writing Our Story? How Do We Engage, Comply, or Resist the Narrative Being Told? And essentially, the presentation was really around who gets to control what narratives that people learn about different identities, different cultures. And so if you think about who kind of owns the different networks, different radio stations, who controls the media, you think about what you've learned about maybe someone from another culture that you're not a part of and kind of what images do you get to see. And so sometimes it's like, well, you know, people make the choice on whether or not they get to perform in this way. But it's also kind of one of those, but if the only options you have to be seen are only in this kind of very narrow point of view, yes, that's a narrative that's being told, but who's telling that narrative, right? Is it really your story? One of the examples I gave was a clip from AJ Plus around like riots, right? Or protesting or whatever you will. And so just the language that they use between, say, people who are protesting after like Ferguson versus like college students destroying property after like their team won a game, right? And so you have essentially people who are in fact actually destroying property, flipping cars, burning couches, you know, all the type of stuff. And you have over here where for the most part, I mean, yes, there were some incidences where people were, you know, breaking things, but there were a couple times where there was absolutely no physical violence, there was no disruption of property, and yet the language that was being used around essentially Black people protesting was a very different narrative.
So you're talking about, we're learning about who's responsible for the misrepresentation of the community. Is there a definite answer to that?
If you think about who controls the media, so even if people want to put out some different type of narrative, right? So one of the people I had mentioned was Issa Rae, who is kind of an up-and-coming artist who, thanks to things like YouTube, was able to kind of build her own platform in which she could tell the story. It's her initial kind of introduction into kind of media was this series she created called The Misadventures of an Awkward Black Girl. And she did it through YouTube. And so that was an opportunity for her to kind of put something out there that we're not getting to see in media, because if she were to try to go to a network with that, they may not want to put that out there because that doesn't sell or doesn't fit the narrative that they want to be sold. The representation of what was out in the 90s, particularly around Black identity, right? You had Fresh Prince, you had Sister Sister, you had Martin. You had all these different things. But even in that, the narrative was still very narrow. It was very much kind of the two-family household. We didn't see a lot of things around like a single parent, right? So even in that narrative was trying to kind of sugarcoat this idea of what it meant to be Black. But look, Black people have nuclear families. Black people have this identity. So even when it was trying to be positive, it was almost too narrow. I think it's coming from a couple different directions of what are people allowing you to put out there, and then also trying to kind of overcompensate sometimes for things. But I think now we're starting to see, because we're seeing the viability of shows that have like Fresh Off the Boat, Blackish, these different shows that are, and Jane the Virgin, where folks from communities of color, people who have traditionally been marginalized, queer people, there's a market for them, that we're now being able to see this, what we would say, like a balkanization of characters, where you can see a more broad characterization of people and not so much of a narrow view, because you can have multiple shows that can show these different aspects of these various communities.
What other forms of media do we see misrepresentation? So you touched up a lot on television.
Yeah.
Do we see it a lot on things like Twitter, like Facebook, Instagram?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, news magazines. I mean, if you think about the different ways in which headlines are posted or shared. So just even the title. So one of the things I showed in my presentation was just the image between after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. There was two images. One was two white people who were perceived as white, and one, which was a black man. And the writing in that was on the white couple. Couple finds food after, you know, Hurricane Katrina. On the image of the black man, it was looting, right? It's very simple. It's very simple. But it leads to this very different understanding, right? Because language is really important. It really means something. And so when you hear the term looting, it's like, oh, he's taking things that are not his. Whereas you hear finding, it's like, oh, they're trying to survive, right? And so it sends this kind of level of, like, even though you don't realize it's happening, right, it's coding this type of image in your mind around this person. And so, I mean, if you think about, you know, lawyers in the courtroom, and they might, you know, they're leading a character, they might ask you, how fast was the driver going when they crashed into the back of your car? Well, if I say crash, even though you don't realize it, you're thinking, oh, they were going really fast. So, like, oh, they might have only been going, like, 35 miles per hour, but when you hear crash, subconsciously, you're like, oh, they were going, like, 65 miles per hour. Whereas if I said, how fast were they going when they tapped the back of your car? Oh, well, they were going, like, 20 miles per hour, right? Like, and even though you, like, right now we're talking about it, like, oh, no, I wouldn't do that. But when you're in those different types of moments, that level of subconscious moves in and it takes over into your brain because it gives you codes to make connections to, right? So I think you see it in newsprint, you see it in news articles when we think around, particularly around images of women. I mean, now, again, we're starting to see a movement where we're seeing more acceptance of quote-unquote plus size, which is really just the average size for most people. You know, so, like, a plus size model is a size 12. Well, most women are 12, 14. So it's like, okay, whatever. But so that type of thing that happens, or just even the, you know, there was just backlash around the new Gap campaign that came out. And part of it was, like, it's very subtle, but it's like you have one black girl in this image, and there's a taller white girl sitting next to her, and she's resting her arm on top of the black girl's head. And it's like, it's very subtle, but it's kind of like, okay, wait, so you're using this person as an actual prop. Like, here she is in this way, and right. And so some people may not see it that way, but other people would, and see this type of level of thing of using this person as a piece of property still. You see it with politicians. You see it, I mean, you think about how the infamous welfare queen that Ronald Reagan talked about, that had like six made up names and was getting all this stuff, which of course was not an actual person. It was just like this narrative, but we still talk about this infamous welfare queen, even though we know that this person didn't actually exist. And even though people have talked about it over and over again, that this person doesn't exist, we still talk about it. When you imagine a person who's on welfare, you often think of a low income person of color, right? Because that's what's been shaped in our mind based on media, based on politicians, based on news, all of these different forms. But reality is that the majority of people on welfare are actually white, right? So realistically, and so Mike Bevin ran on the campaign of repealing Obamacare, which was, Kentucky was one of the few states that really implemented, which they call it Connect. Connect was basically the state version of Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act. And it was really well implemented underneath the previous governor. Mike Bevin ran on the campaign of repealing Obamacare, which meant that he was going to be cutting Medicaid, right? Because that's essentially what it was. It's just an expansion of Medicaid. Kentucky, and most of Kentucky, is very poor. And so all the people who voted, right? Here's a person who blatantly said, I am going to repeal Obamacare. I'm going to do this. This is what I'm going to do. Was then elected and then said, I'm going to repeal Obamacare. And then people go, no, wait, you can't do that because I need my Medicaid. Because they weren't making the connection because of, right? So you think about the language that we heard around what the Obamacare is. And I think Jimmy Kimmel even did with Street News or whatever they call it, or Lie News. Mm-hmm. And he was asking people, what do you prefer, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act? Which is the same thing. And people are like, oh, yeah, the Affordable Care Act is just much better. And like, why? And people can't really tell you why, and they're making up things. I'm like, yeah, but it's the exact same thing. But the way in which Obamacare was vilified, I'm not saying that's a perfect tool or anything like that, but the way that it was very much vilified, people don't even understand what it actually is, but they just know that it's bad based on what they've heard from all of these different places, from news, from media, from politicians, etc. So then now that it's being taken away, they're like, wait, that's what that was? I need that. You can't take that away from me. But, like, he ran on this campaign, and you all voted for him. So the ways in which that shows up for people, because a lot of times it's hard to do your own education because you don't know where to start. We're in a time where it's both easy and really hard to access information because everything is literally at your fingertips, assuming that you have access to, you know, internet, whatever. But then there's so much information you don't even know where to start, and you don't know what's real and you don't know what's fake.
Does the misrepresentation only affect that group of people? Does it affect more people? Does it affect the world around
them? Oh gosh, it affects everyone. I mean, I'll take, right, when we think about the gender, right? If we talk about gender, and not even just the misrepresentation of gender and gender identity and gender role, but the way in which we have develop gender roles in our culture, right? And part of that is around this representation that we have and we've created, that it gets this place that now for people that masculinity has to be this very narrow idea of what it means to be masculine, right? So anyone who falls outside of this narrow defined masculine, because the way we define masculinity is basically an opposition to femininity, right? So anything that's opposite of feminine, therefore, is masculine. And so anything that is close to resembling femininity in a man or someone who's perceived as a man is then perceived as, quote, weak, because that's what we deem as women, right? Is that right? Strong, weak, you know, that type of thing. And so that narrow focus then really makes it hard for men to then live up to a standard that doesn't actually exist. And then I think that creates levels of stress that wouldn't otherwise be there, right? So even though it in ways we think about the ways that which like language between, you know, men and women in like the workplace. So we have like, you know, someone who's, you know, bossy, right? A woman is bossy, but you know, a man is, you know, assertive, right? Same characteristics but different. And so in one way there's a lot of ways in which women who assert masculine types of identities, it's negative, but it doesn't have quite the same impact as it is for a man who is identified in any type of way that's feminine, right? Because we also then associate femininity with being gay. And then we see how that has kind of played out in this culture. The assumption of someone being queer, which could lead to personal violence against a person. In particular, if you look at the number of trans women who have been killed, I mean, 2015, I think we were up to 21 by the end of 2015. 21 trans women. Well, not even that. Trans women of color specifically. So that's not even including any trans women who were not women of color who were murdered, right? And that's because if you think right, this idea, here's men who transition to women. And that level of you can't do that, right? Even if you think about the way we talk about kind of gay men versus lesbians, right? We're pretty cool with lesbians as a culture. Like we're down for that. Like, I can handle that. But gay men, not so much, right? Because again, this frailty around what it means to be masculine, and we quickly associate masculinity, you know, this opposite, right? So these are things that people have then perceived because that somehow is feminine, therefore you're not masculine, therefore you must be gay, therefore I must do violence against you. And so those different types of things play out and can be very, very traumatic. Now, it's very rare. I think we're now in a different place. Where it's not quite there anymore, and I think people are able to kind of blur the lines a little bit. If you think about, like, Odell Beckham, right? So everything, all the rumors swirling around, whether or not he's gay or not, because he's got blonde-tipped hairs, and he was dancing in a video with his friend with his shirt off, and he one time was on the field doing ballet, being silly in the end zone. So those three things collectively mean he's gay? I mean, even if he is, like, one, why does it matter? But, like, why do those three specific things are the reasons that people keep coming up that he must be gay? I'm like, what does that even mean? And then also, can he not be gay and also play football? Like, I don't understand, like, these things, right? So there's just these ways in which that we then box people into a place where if they are anywhere outside of it, it means unacceptance and it could potentially lead to violence.
So you mentioned all these problems that is going on with misrepresentation. So how do we go about fixing it? Do we do it through media, do it word of mouth, or, you know, how's the best form of
I think
attack?
It starts really with education in and of itself, right? So we think about our educational system, we think about, like who wrote our history books, right? So you think about the stories that you learned in your school around different communities, different spaces, right? It's often written from the point of view of people who are not in that community. So part of that is the reason why different history months were developed in the first place, is so that there would be an introduction to Black history, to Latino history, to Native history, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think part of that is not, I would love for there not to be a need to have a Black History Month, right? Because that means that Black history, Latino history, et cetera, was deeply webbed into the curriculum that students are taught from a very young age, right? So getting to learn and read from these other people's kind of personal narratives and their point of views, and not only hanging out with people within your own community. So actually getting to know folks from a variety of different communities will help you kind of be able to, and that can get tricky too, because if you have a very small group of friends and it becomes, well, this person does fit this kind of narrative that I've seen, yay, confirmation, but that's also just one person and everyone's experience is really different. So I think in part it starts with kind of how are we educating people, what type of history are we actually telling, how are we weaving in various cultures in our different ways, and, you know, with even in math, right? Simple thing, like you do, like, oh, here's the way the Chinese do math, like, hey, that's a very interesting way to think about that. Like, I didn't know they did math differently. That's a thing. No one does the same. They don't do math the same way that we do. Like, I didn't know that. Like, so, I mean, there's different ways that you can incorporate it there, and in which you've been learning about these different narratives. You're hearing from different points of view. I think getting outside of our own comfort zones, really getting to know people, which is probably, I mean, you hear colleges talk about that all the time and the need for that, and that's why diversity is so important. But I think it ultimately helps in the long run, because if you're going into any type of company, you need to know how to market to people, and you can't know how to market to people if you don't know those people. A creation of more platforms for folks who are kind of in the margins to tell their own stories, to write their own things. And I think the rise of things like YouTube, I mean, I think there was a study that was done a couple years ago. It was like between ages of like 14 and 24, people who were like celebrities for that age group were not the people that we see on media and TV. It was like the top 10, other than Vin Diesel, because he has a huge social media presence as well, what were all people who were like YouTube celebrities, right? And that part because it's a different media form, it's an access that people are getting to. There weren't really, you know, that age group wasn't really paying attention to regular TV anymore. It's still a much kind of older crowd. And so that platform of like YouTube or all these different places where people are now able to create their own content and they're not controlled by whoever, then you're seeing something that's a little bit different. But now because of that, it's pushing traditional media outlets to kind of change what type of things they're offering in the news, right? Social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc. is really pushing still, you know, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, they still suck a little bit, and by a little bit, I mean a lot, around what they're producing, because again, they're still also controlled. But because of things like Twitter, if you think about like the Zimmerman case, was really one of the first kind of things where it was, you know, it was out there, but because of the social media presence, that was what made major news channels really start covering that case, because otherwise they wouldn't have, right? If it wasn't for Twitter, if it wasn't for Facebook, if it wasn't for whatever else is out, I mean, Snapchat wasn't out yet then, so. But, right, so those different types of things and these different types of platforms are kind of pushing current access points to kind of shift what they're doing. So I think continue to kind of make new content and putting it out there in a way that is accessible to more people will help shift the kind of the narratives that are being told in mainstream media.
Well, is there any kind of last thing you want to say maybe that I didn't really touch up on that you're really dying to get out there to let people know?
There's no simple answer for anything, right? Everything has to kind of, it's one of those, like, what comes first, right? Do we change the media? Do we change the people? And I think things have to happen simultaneously. I think Ellen is a great example of, were we really ready for this queer woman to kind of be out in this public space when she was? Or, like, I think this is one of those things where the people were ready. underneath, but we weren't really, really talking about it. But media wasn't really showing it. And so then it was like, once she was there, then it was like, oh, people are cool with that. All right, great. Okay, well, let's do more of this. This is great. And these different access points. And so I think things are happening simultaneously. But I do think in a lot of ways, media outlets in particular as a form really helps push conversations. And now with social media, I think the ability to access information is important, but I also think it's really, really important for people to check their sources. Please. It's like, please, please. And I think it's also important too, like for myself, I make sure I actually, in fact, it hurts my heart a little bit sometimes, like watch Fox News and or read stuff on Fox News. I'm super liberal and I will admit that. But I have to because, you know, folks on the left are not always right. And I think it is interesting to find out what people are saying on the right and to kind of do some comparative and understanding around, you know, where are different views. And I think that's really important for people when they really want to learn about these different narratives, right? You have to go to multiple sources. And I think that that's going to be the best way for all of us kind of moving forward to kind of understand humans, right? We're all very complex. And the very last thing is to go make some new friends. Make some new friends. Get to know some different people. Go hang out in some communities that maybe you wouldn't normally. People like to talk to me all the time. It's really weird. I don't know if I have a face or something. Like today was talking to me about my license plate. It was like, yeah, I'm moved here from Louisiana. It's exciting. 20-minute conversation around New Orleans. It's so exciting. Yay. It's weird. I don't know. But I'm down with that because that is giving someone who maybe not otherwise wouldn't talk to someone who looks like me an opportunity to have a friendly conversation with someone who does. And maybe that will open their door to go talk to somebody else who doesn't look like them in the future.
That was Forrest Solis in conversation with Desiree Anderson.
This next segment is all about the topic of artivism. We will look at a children's book that has been turned into a play. Consider a college student's vision and aspirations to bring the worlds of art and healing together, and explore the process that went into creating the film, Liari Notes.
In the next piece, author Mitali Perkins shares her journey to writing the book, Rickshaw Girl with Lisa Perkins.
Mitali Perkins became a writer with the vision of touching hearts and minds simultaneously. In 2008, her book, The Rickshaw Girl, was published. It was the story of a young girl in Bangladesh who wanted to help her family earn money, but couldn't because of her gender. Nearly a decade later, the book has made into a play at the Bay Area Children's Theater and is slated to become a movie. We sat down with Mitali in a coffee shop in her hometown of Arinda, California. The bustling ambient sound of the coffee shop is what makes her feel most at home when she is writing. Mitali begins to tell us how her father has impacted her career and her writing.
A small book, and it came right out of my experience with my dad, because even though everyone cried when I was born, my dad was always like, no, this is God's child, this is a child of God, she's, you know, I'm so glad she's a daughter. He just always championed me, so I got to put that in the book, and I guess that, you know, it's my dad's favorite book, so I think it's probably closest to my heart. I wrote the book a long time ago, and we had lived in Bangladesh for 3 years, and I had met rickshaw drivers, and I'd seen the beautiful art, and I'd learned about how hard it is for girls to work. So the book came out of that time. It kind of just didn't sell that well. But then bit by bit, it just started to reach an audience. And so I guess somebody read it and thought it would be a good play. And then to my total complete amazement, they adapted it into a play. And it's been playing now in San Ramon and San Francisco and now moving to Berkeley. And I went to see it. And I was sitting in the theater and these people are acting out my play. And I totally forgot I had written it. So I was sitting there thinking, what's going to happen to this little girl? And then all of a sudden I was like, you dummy, you wrote the book. It was very strange to see it acted out like that. It's a story about duty and honor and courage. And I think those are universal themes. And especially children, you think children can't understand the theme of, you know, wanting to make, when you make a mistake, wanting to make things right. But that's kind of a universal thing. And there's a point in the book where, and in the play, where she does this big, makes a big mistake. And when I was at the play, all these children just gasped, like, So I think part of it is that even though it's set so far away, it's every work of fiction really is both a window into another culture, but also a mirror where you're reading a book set in Bangladesh in a village with a poor family, and you see yourself reflected there. You know, you think, I know what it's like to make a big mistake. I know what it's like to have to make things right. So I think that's part of the magic of fiction, is that it's a window and a mirror. It was always my safe place. I loved to read, and I still reread the same books I read back then. And I think I love a sense of place, and so because I moved around so much, I didn't really have a home place. So I ended up reading, and when I read and loved a book, that place became my place. And so those old books that I read again and again and again were sort of my home, away from home. And I was realizing how powerful stories are. You know, I studied political science and public policy, and I wanted to help people care about the poor. And if you can do a lot to change our minds, but stories open hearts, right? I mean, they change your hearts and your mind. So I was seeing that happening to me. I was reading books that were making me care about justice and about the poor, and I thought, this is a really powerful thing, storytelling. It can really change people's hearts and the way people look at each other. I wrote a book, and I thought it was kind of crazy, the book I wrote. But my agent said, let's send it out and see what happens. This is last summer. And so she sent it out, and it was the first time any of my books had happened to, because I had 8 editors that wanted it. And so last summer it went into auction, which means people were bidding against each other for it. And I was just sitting there getting these emails thinking, this is insane, because it's never happened. You know, pretty far along in my career, and just never happened. I just got rejection after rejection. So it's still the joy of the craft. It's still when I write and you get in that flow. I hope you guys find something like this, where you just all of a sudden you're out of time and you're just thinking about what you're doing, and it's just this flow, and you feel so creative and energized. You could be, you know, 60 years old or 20 years old, it doesn't even matter. You're just in the flow, and that's when it's fun. So I think, yeah, that's what kept me going those years, that and a good husband.
That was Mitali Perkins, author of Rickshaw Girl.
Up next, Anobong Akan Itu talks with Anna Agosta about her passion for merging out healing and social justice as an art therapy major.
When thinking about methods of healing, people often turn to medicine or counseling. Ina Bongo Kanatuk, a senior at St. Mary's College of California majoring in art therapy, envisioned a different path to healing. Originally a physical therapy major, she came to the realization that science was not her strong suit. Having always been interested in people, she became interested in combining art, healing, and social change.
My name is Enobong Akanetok, and I am an art therapy major. I'm a senior. I am part of the Black Student Union. I work in the Intercultural Center. That's what I currently do. That's mostly it.
So what interested you in using art to talk about social justice issues?
I've noticed that the longer and longer I spend at St. Mary's, I came in like wanting to help people, you know, so I came in doing physical therapy, then I noticed, oh, you know, science is not the right track for me. Mm-hmm. Let's try, you know, art therapy. And I noticed that art can actually really heal people. So I was like, oh, what would that look like if we combine that with social justice? Because in the end, they're both trying to get people out of an oppressive, unhealthy situation and something that's more functional for them.
In terms of just art therapy, could you tell me your own story with art and healing?
I feel like for me, I was like an only child, so it's kind of lonely. But I feel like art was like the one class I knew I could do well in and excel in. And it was very therapeutic, especially because I took ceramics. That was the first art class I took. So if there's ever a problem, you know, stressed out, you go in ceramics class, get to beat up some clay, you know, like throw it around, score it, you know, slam it everywhere. And it was very like relaxing and calming. And I noticed that I was able to focus and concentrate more in that class than like any other class. So for me, it started in high school. And it was just like a break from my already hectic schedule.
Going off of that, was high school when you first like really became interested in art? Or was there a time before that where you were just like, where you knew like you just liked art?
I always knew that I liked it, but it was more like in a crafting sense. Mm-hmm. And it didn't shift to like, there's two ways of perceiving art. It didn't shift into like a technical skill mm-hmm. in high school. And then it didn't shift to like art as like a process, a means of production until college, which was a completely new way of approaching art. But I always knew, but it wasn't like really brought up and evident until high school.
What's been the greatest lesson that you've learned with art healing and social change?
For me, it actually came through last year. My biggest lesson I learned was that it's honestly not about the end production, it's about the process behind it. I had a class, and for my midterm, what I thought I made an art piece, but he said, it's not art, it's activism. And I was like, okay, you're wrong. But then I really took in what he was saying, and I sat with it, And then come time for my final, I really understood what art meant. It's more of the planning you put into, the critiquing you put into, as opposed to just like paper on pencil drawing and that's art. You know, it's more of like contextualizing it. Why are you doing it? What are you trying to say? Like all that deep stuff. Almost like writing a paper.
And so earlier you said that like your first, like in your first class in high school was ceramics. What's your favorite form of art?
My favorite is ceramics. Like, unfortunately, I haven't been able to do it since high school. But my favorite is ceramics, if not painting. I really like painting because if you make a mistake, you can get away with it. Just blend it in. Yeah. As opposed to, like, drawing, it's like, oh, you mess up on that eye. It's slanted. They're uneven. I'm like, okay, don't look that close. You're looking, just, you know, back up a few feet and then, you know, squint your eyes, tilt your head.
Who inspired you to pursue art therapy, especially besides your own personal experiences?
I can't say it's a particular person, but I have always had this capacity to care for people. And I've always wanted to help people long term. You know, like career-wise. So it wasn't like one individual. It's just more of like my wanting to help people and wanting to heal them. And then realizing that art therapy was my way of doing so.
In your pieces, do you focus on any specific social justice issue?
For me, what I've been, within the last year, I've really been focusing on the silencing of Black people in America and how that's being perpetuated. And
are there ever any moments when people discouraged what you were doing in trying to combine art, social justice, art therapy?
It's so funny because I feel like if you're not involved in social justice, then you may not completely understand why. So I come from a Nigerian background. And basically, if you're not a doctor, a lawyer, engineer, or a nursing, then you need to switch your profession. And so there's a lot of family members, immediate and like extended, who were just like off put by it because they're saying, oh, what are you studying? Art therapy. All I heard was art. And first of all, if I do study art, you know what? I can change the world with that. But all they heard was art. You know, I'm like, oh, I'm going to be a therapist, like, you know, a counselor, like psychologist. Yeah. You know, I'm just using art to heal. So a lot of family. But overall, it's been nice to have a lot of support, like from people on campus. Mm-hmm. So that's always good to have to balance that out or cancel it out.
You mentioned that Kara Walker and Keith Haring are some of your favorite artists. So what about them?
I was first introduced to Keith Haring in my ceramics class. Mm-hmm. And I think I was just attracted to how simple his pieces are. But yet they say a lot. It's reinventing the idea of a stick figure. Because his paintings are mostly like stick figures or like cartoonish characters like that. And people just see them as like, oh, you know, like I'm not an artist. All I can do is stick figures. But look at an artist using that as his means of promoting social justice. And I really agree like with his topics that he spoke about through his art, which is mostly like LGBTQIA+ rights and equality. And Kara Walker, I was introduced to her last year. I love how subtle, I guess my thing is simplicity. Mm-hmm. Like, I love how simple and not even subtle. I love how simple her method is because she does silhouettes. Mm-hmm. So it's literally black images on a white background. And it's just one of those things where it's like when you see her pieces, you just stop. Because at first it just looks like, oh, a sick, you know, like a silhouette. But you're forced to just stop and look at it and not have any distractions around you. Just really like stay with her piece and analyze mm-hmm. what she's saying. And she deals with like slavery and black issues and the abuse of women back in the days and black people as a whole. Mm-hmm. So she's definitely someone who influences me in like my art in regards to social justice. Mm-hmm. I just love how they were able to use this as a means to fight for something that was so dear to them. Mm-hmm. That's why they're some of my favorites, and I really admire them.
Nice. Thank you for your time.
Oh, of course.
That was Anna Agosta in conversation with Inobong Akanitu.
Islamophobia and xenophobia have become increasingly normalized during the GOP presidential race. Filmmaker Maheen Zia sent out to present a new narrative about Pakistan in her film Lurari Notes. It's a story about music changing the lives of young girls in the city called Lahari, Pakistan. Molly Baker and Sharon Skobata speak with Zia about her journey about making the film.
My journey with this film began with an email from Miriam Chandi Menachery, who's my co-director and co-producer. She's based in Mumbai in India, and I'm based in Karachi in Pakistan. And she wanted to pursue this idea, and she asked if I'd be interested in collaborating with her. And her idea was to explore underground musicians in Pakistan, their popularity across the border, and how music is a source for dialogue between two countries where at the state level it seems to be failing. That's the genesis of this film. So it's a film with very young protagonists. So the film is following this musician, Hamza Jafri, who has a band called Kavan that's quite popular in the underground music scene in India and Pakistan. And not only is he a musician, he's also an educator. He has opened two music schools, one in Lahore and one in Karachi. There's not very much music education in Pakistan. So they would expect to see him and some of his motivation and journey. As well as the film follows four young girls from a district of Karachi called Liari, which is often in the news for being inaccessible or troubled because of violence. But there's other sides of the district that one doesn't get to know.
Earlier, you focused on a school. It was a co-ed school, but in the end, in the direction you decided to go was to focus on four young girls. And one of the things that becomes really clear to viewers of the film is that these four girls, as they're studying music, they're breaking through many cultural boundaries and maybe realizing new possibilities. So talk about that.
The children from Liari that were attending MAD school, MAD stands for Music, Art and Dance. That's the school that Hamza runs with his wife, Nida Bhatt. The Music, Art and Dance school was running a scholarship program for children from Liari through the help of a foundation that works with children in Liari called the Kiran Foundation. They had to convince parents to send their children to the program. And initially, a very small number agreed because they were kind of hesitant with the idea of the children going somewhere and learning music and what it could mean. So eventually, out of 12 children went, and they went for about a year and a half, from whom four girls continued on to a final performance with a larger group. So it ended up being about these four girls that we followed.
So you have lived in Pakistan for most of your entire life?
Yes, that's correct.
And you are a filmmaker there. So what's it like to sustain yourself as a filmmaker in Pakistan? What's kind of your story that led you in this direction, and what's it like to continue sustaining yourself in this way?
Surprisingly, there are quite a few women in the media in Pakistan, and I've also taught filmmaking at university level in Karachi, and the majority of my students were women. So it's a misconception that it's a man's world, this industry. I think people also might be surprised that there have been quite a few women working in film and television in Pakistan. And personally, as a documentary filmmaker, I find, because I feel that I'm still learning documentary.
Did you encounter parental resistance when you said, hey, I'm going to become a filmmaker, that's what I'm going to do with my life? Were your parents on board with that?
Perhaps, like most parents, they were concerned, how will you survive? You know, but nevertheless, I think I was very fortunate because my father was a great believer in that. If your heart is in it, then at least you have a chance to excel. That's what made him say, all right.
What was the most challenging part about making this film?
I think the challenges would be the nuts and bolts. Yeah, the film was a creative collaboration between two people in different countries with a hostile border. Initially, we thought that maybe Miriam will come to Pakistan for some of the filming and I might go to India for some of the editing, but that didn't transpire. We agreed then I would film it and I would send the footage to her and she would edit it. But of course, we were raising money for it as we went along. So we had deadlines. And because of the relations between Pakistan and India, I could ship hard drives out of Pakistan to her. I had to wait for people who would be traveling abroad, who would be willing to carry the hard drive with the material for me and then mail it to her in time for her to be able to go through the rushes and edit them. I couldn't mail hard drives out of Pakistan. It's not allowed. And definitely not to India, for sure. I mean, that would also raise eyebrows. So I had to find people who would be willing to carry the hard drives. Video is, we're shooting 4K, so it ends up being quite many gigabytes of material. You can't just transfer it online. So I had to wait for friends who might be traveling to Dubai or to the US or wherever who'd be willing to, who trusted me enough to know I wasn't partaking in any espionage. I was actually trying to send some material across to make a documentary, which was a story we wanted to tell about a soft side of Pakistan. So these human mules were found and used. Well, we got lucky. We were able to do it, but it was always tense. because we also were working with deadlines for trailers and edits to be shared with potential funders in order for us to have the money to be able to make this.
What was something that you noticed about yourself that changed, or like how did you see yourself grow as a filmmaker and as a human being while you were making this?
I had to learn a lot of patience and sort of trust the process.
When you were creating this film, like, what brought you the most joy?
Oh, when I had the camera pointed in the right direction and the mic on and managed to record a nugget that I felt, oh, this I'm sure is going to go in the film. That's always joyous, because your worst fear as a filmmaker is that, you know, you're not directing action, it's happening. You have to be there to catch it.
And a few of the nuggets that really stuck out to me, there's a moment where this children are talking about this act of violence that happened in the country, and this was the 2014 incident that happened, taking the lives of more than 100 children. Can you talk about what the incident was and kind of what impact that had on children in the country, children in the film, and the country as a whole?
So the incident was an attack on an army public school in Peshawar in Pakistan, where militants stormed and attacked a school and killed about 135 children. This happened perhaps because the Pakistan is a victim of terrorism itself. Because the army has been going after the terrorist strongholds, there's backlash. This was the first time in the country that a school was targeted and children were targeted, and it shook the nation. I remember it was incredibly depressing. The atmosphere was thick with depression in the country. Everyone was shaken by it, and as a result, over time, schools have had to beef up their security. So it has entered the consciousness of children that somehow something horrible can happen even to them in their school. It's possible. It was towards the ending of our filming that the Army Public School in Peshawar was attacked, and we were able to follow the children to a vigil and interview them and their families, as they themselves processed the news and tried to come to terms with it and also develop a strategy for dealing with it, I mean, as they were learning to deal with it.
And there's a very sweet moment where this little girl is saying, well, whoever did that, they could not have been Muslim, because my religion would never allow for something like that to happen.
What they might perceive to be extremism and violent Islam, what they might equate with religion, they'll find that Muslims themselves don't equate with as their religion, and they themselves disassociate themselves with extremism and violent expressions.
So we've touched on a lot of things. We've touched on the power of music to build a bridge between countries through children as kind of a carrier of a message of peace, girls in particular. What would be the main thing that you hope the international audience would take away from this film as they watch?
I've been surprised sitting in audiences and people are laughing where at the funny moments, getting all the jokes, getting all the nuances. So that's very hopeful for me. That means we are able to read each other. We are able to recognize each other.
So thinking about your journey thus far as a filmmaker, as a woman, it sounds like you've done some big projects over the years. What would you say is the most important lesson you've learned on your journey, and how did you learn that?
I think don't take anything for granted. The technology is the easy thing to learn, but how you engage with people, how you engage with stories, and how you bring them to the screen, it's a very subjective process, but it's very important to keep asking yourself what your motivations are for what you filmed and how you're presenting it, and whether it corresponds to what you understand to be true. So that's a process of refinement. I think it's important as a filmmaker to keep that open. And I think in that process, you might learn things about yourself. We have a saying that you don't dip into the same stream twice. So change is a constant. We can't hold on to anything. We have to embrace it, and we have to be willing to submit to it. And I hope I am able to do that myself. That way, perhaps I might grow. If I resist it, I think I can create problems for myself.
Yeah. Well, our listeners will probably want to track you down or learn more about your film. So tell us how we can find out more about you or find out more about this film.
There's a website, learinotes.com. We spell it LYARINOTES.com. And Miriam and I are planning an outreach strategy where we take the film into workshops, into settings where we can use it as a tool to talk about the importance of arts education.
That was Maheen Zia, filmmaker of Liari Notes, in conversation with Molly Baker and Sharon Scabata. The final segment is all about people's own personal stories and the politics that come with it. Connor will share his own experience in dealing with tobacco addiction as a baseball player. We will hear from a single mother, a mother who has immigrated to the United States, and Kayla will share her experiences in dealing with racism on St. Mary's campus.
About 4 out of every 10 children in the United States are born to unwed mothers. Roughly 5 million college students are raising children. Jamie Sebert sat down with Marisol Padilla, a 22-year-old parent in college. Padilla reflected on the struggles and triumphs of raising a child on her own while attending college.
How has St. Mary's been preparing you?
I've actually been a part of the event staff for the athletic department. It started off as a project with one of my kines classes, actually. We were required to do sort of a mini internship for the semester with the athletic department. And we all shadowed a certain athletic facility staff member, and I shadowed Mark Papadopoulos. So I feel like that kind of helped me. I worked basketball games and soccer games, and it led me to actually working for him and actually getting paid for it.
And then I can talk about
that. Is there anything else you've done related to your major so far, or related to your future career plans?
I've been a part of the campus activities board at St. Mary's for the past 3 years. I first applied my first year to be hired on as a sophomore. I started off as a publicity assistant, so I helped publicize all of our events and work our social media outlets. My junior year, I was hired as the special events coordinator. So I handled all of the larger scale events for the entire undergraduate class. And this final year, I was hired as the director of the board. So I've overseen the board this past year.
How many classes are you currently taking?
I'm currently taking 5 classes, 4 regular classes, and 1 quarter credit.
And then how many hours do you spend a week doing anything for GAB?
About 8 to 10 hours a week.
And then are you working outside, or is that your main job?
No, I also work as a sales associate at Sports Authority.
And how many hours a week do you work at Sports Authority?
It averages usually like 20 to 30 hours a week.
So going back to you being a senior, what do you think your biggest challenge was in the past 4 years at St. Mary's?
My biggest challenge is finding a way to balance my school and work and my life and family all at once and making sure I graduate on time without having to come back another year semester.
How is family incorporated into your daily life?
Well, I have a son, so that's a huge part of my life. I'm constantly thinking about and figuring out what I could do to better his life and make sure he has everything he needs at the moment, as well as my family, as in my dad and my mom and my sister, making sure they're well off too and not struggling in any sense.
How old is your son?
He is 1.5 years.
What's his name?
His name's Dominic.
How often do you get to see him?
I'm currently living in an apartment in Lafayette, but he does not live here. He stays back home in Stockton with my parents. I don't get to see him every day because of school and work, but if I'm not at school or work, I am back home in Stockton with him.
So you have to commute all the way over there?
Yeah, I commute back and forth probably about 3 to 4 times a week.
You had Dominic 1.5 years ago, so was that challenging?
It was challenging. I did have a lot of support from my advisor at St. Mary's and a lot of my professors that I had at the time. While I was pregnant, they definitely supported me a lot through everything, and a lot of no sleep would be how I got through this.
How do you think your experiences these last 4 years have shaped who you are today?
I definitely think the past 4 years have changed me for the better. They've shaped me into a whole new person, of a person I didn't even think I could possibly be, if that makes sense.
What kind of person are you now in comparison to the person you were 4 years ago?
I guess you could say I'm more aware of things around me, like, I guess, just world-wise, things going on in the world and seeing things from a different perspective. More mature, definitely, I would say, than what I was 4 years ago. And I mean, growing up in Stockton, you kind of just have like your own little bubble of how things are. And going from Stockton, which has been ranked for very bad reasons, and then coming into Moraga, which is a pretty wealthy community, it's just a culture shock and a big difference. And I feel like it's definitely changed me.
What do you think the most important lesson you've learned in the past 4 years is?
I think the most important thing is realizing that not everybody grew up the same way you did, which makes it difficult for everybody to understand each other. Because I know, especially my first year at St. Mary's, like I did not really connect with a lot of people on certain things because we just grew up a lot differently. And it took me a while to get accustomed to how things were at St. Mary's, of how like the mixture of everybody's backgrounds and their experiences and just the way they deal with life and issues, and like having like sometimes it like conflicted with the way like I saw things, but just finding that balance of like understanding each other.
So what was your biggest reward since attending St. Mary's?
My biggest reward, I think, would be making it all 4 years as a student leader. Yeah.
How would you depict yourself as a student leader?
Well, being a part of the Campus Activities Board, we are a part of the Associated Students, which is not a lot of people know, is the governing community of the entire undergraduate class. And it's more a lot of behind the scenes of like I'm involved in very different like contributions and organizations and departments throughout the campus. And I'm part of the Gales Party Safe Initiative, which I created 3 years ago. And just seeing that take off and like actually like, you know, be ahead of the campaign and like have my face on posters, making sure, you know, people are being safe out there. It's pretty rewarding.
When you got pregnant, do you think that was like more pressure because you were a face of the school?
I think it was. I think that's why I hesitated to even, I mean, make it public that I obviously knew I was pregnant. My friends knew that I was pregnant, but I didn't really want anybody else to know, just because I did feel like I was in some sort of position where I had a role on campus, and just knowing that everybody else now was going to see me differently kind of affected the way I continued my roles on campus.
How did you think they were going to see you differently?
I mean, just the fact that it's a private Catholic institution, you know, and just not every day that you see a unmarried pregnant girl walking around campus. And just knowing that, I mean, like I said earlier, a lot of people do grow up differently, and maybe that's not the norm for them back home, you know, even to get pregnant out of wedlock or that young or whatever. So I just knew people were going to have different opinions.
And did you experience any of these opinions or views?
I didn't personally hear anything, but it was a lot of more like, I guess like people felt bad for me, and I could feel it. I could feel like in even the tone of voice that they talked to me in, or like the certain choices of words they would say like around me, like I knew it was, they were being very cautious of like what it was said and done around me.
So did you appreciate that?
I don't know if I necessarily appreciated it, because they made it very obvious, you know, so it was kind of like a, okay, here you are trying to be nice to me type of thing. Like, I don't know necessarily if it was genuine, you know. Like, after a while, though, like, I mean, having experienced it a lot, I was able to tell who was genuine about it and who wasn't. And I think it really depended person by person if I appreciated it or not.
How would you know if it was not genuine?
I wouldn't say it was more like in a sarcastic tone, but like it would kind of just be like a, oh, okay, type of thing. Whereas in someone genuine, we wouldn't ask the basic questions that everybody would ask just to get information out of, like, you know, just to like know, like it would more ask about like my well-being and my like, oh, are you like, how are you actually doing? Are you like, are you holding in okay? Is everything, you know, do you need help with anything and stuff like that? Like those were the actual genuine people besides, oh, so what happened? Like, who's the dad? Which was one of the most famous questions, you know, and stuff like that. And it was a big difference in question asking.
How did you deal with these questions?
Honestly, half the time I wouldn't even answer them. probably just like answer them and like, I wouldn't say with like another question or just like a very non-specific answers. It was a personal thing. It was my life, my business, and I didn't think that I needed to share with the entire school, especially the people that I, like, didn't even talk to. Like, I probably talked to once a semester, and then they came up to me wanting to know my life, and it was just really odd, like, like, why they were so intrigued to know. And I think that's part of the reason why, like, I kept it a secret was because it's, like, to me, it was just strange that everybody wanted to know.
But now, do you think it has changed since you've had the baby?
I definitely think they're seeing me differently. I'm not really sure what they expected at first because a lot of people, like, especially now getting closer to graduation, like, I'll see them in the hallway and we'll, like, you know, quick catch up, like, hey, how's it been? Good. And then they'll be like, wait, you're graduating, right? Like, that's happening. And I'm just like, yes. Yes, like, I did it, like, I'll be walking the stage with you guys, like, it's okay, like, you know, and stuff like that. So it's, like, it's weird to see, like, how many people actually question the fact that I would be graduating, and a lot of people are kind of, like, just expect it, but then remember that, like, you know, I did have a kid and did go through all this, and then they question, oh, wait, are you or are you not? And so, yeah, I definitely see that difference.
What do you think your biggest motivation was for overcoming all of these obstacles?
I think my biggest motivation would be to just, growing up where I did, like, not a lot of people make it. Like, a lot of them get stuck back home and never really do anything with their lives. And I think definitely seeing people still back there and knowing that I had the opportunity to even go to college and have the chance to make it makes me keep going to make sure that I actually get to a successful point in life where I feel proud of myself. And I don't want to know that I had the opportunity and just missed it or messed up somehow. So no matter what life throws at me, like getting pregnant, I don't want anything to stop me from taking this opportunity.
So would you consider yourself proud of yourself?
Right now I'd say yeah. I am proud of myself knowing that, like, I am graduating next month. Yeah.
So do you see yourself as a role model?
I mean, I never really thought about it, but I mean, I guess, yeah. I mean, I would hope people, like, if anybody else was struggling or going through stuff, would look at me and, like, know that they could do it too.
That was Jamie Sebert in conversation with Marisol Padilla.
Finding your way on college campus can be a trying experience for people from marginalized identities. Kayla Evans shared her story of combining her personal politics with her identity both inside and outside the classroom.
There's an unspoken moment for people of color in which we truly realize the gravity of all that's against us. Not the moment that we realize what being brown means, but the moment we truly understand how global anti-blackness is, how deeply it goes, and how hard it is to escape. For me, it happened my freshman year of college when I decided to major in my passion for activism. That is, I declared my major in women and gender studies with a minor in ethnic studies. I wanted to pair my passion and drive for achieving equality with the theory and application that I'd learned in college classes. I learned to compartmentalize school, politics, and my personal life. They'd never mixed until this point. I couldn't separate all the theory and history that I was learning from myself. Once you learn about something, you can't unlearn it. Once you have the words for something, you can suddenly understand it better. I remembered every micro and macro aggression against me, and they hurt like fresh wounds. I remembered every harmful thing I'd said, and I wanted to kick myself. I mostly noticed everything that continued to happen. It wasn't a thing of the past like the central narrative wanted us to think. It continued to happen every day, even on my college campus in 2013. The only thing that had changed was that now I could see it in full color, and it weighed on me so heavily. I didn't want to go to class because I was afraid of what my classmates would say about anything that had to do with race, gender, or sexuality. Sometimes I didn't even do my readings because it physically hurt to read about systemic oppression. I stayed away from social media. For the longest time, I only felt two things, exhaustion and anger. It was draining. I felt trapped on my small college campus up on the hill. I didn't trust a lot of people. It would make or break a lot of my relationships. Stay woke or stay away from me. Why would I want to be friends with people who only perpetuated my suffering? Jokes aren't so harmless when they normalize dangerous stereotypes about a group you belong to. I'd sunk deeper into my depression and my anxiety was heightened. I developed a dangerous eating disorder. If I couldn't control the state of the world, I could at least control my eating and my weight. I want to say that eventually everything got better. That now, I'm a junior, and suddenly the world stopped being awful, and people became more accepting. That I'm no longer depressed, and I'm free of my eating disorder. But it didn't, and I'm not. I've simply learned to cope and still be productive. I found safe spaces with other minority students on campus, and a solid group of friends who get it. I found safer means of expression in writing, in music and theater, in picking up a megaphone and leading a march across campus. In organizing student activist work on my own campus. I'm struggling, and I still have moments of hopelessness, exhaustion, and rage, but I'm working on it. I'm devoting myself to change and learning to let myself breathe and take care of myself. So maybe in a few years, another little queer Afro-Latina with a big heart and big dreams and big hair can come to college and not have to face the hardships that I did.
That was Kayla Evans sharing her journey with embracing her identity at SMC.
According to Florida Health, smokeless users have an 80% higher risk of oral cancer and a 60% higher risk of pancreatic and esophagus cancer. This is an issue that impacted me. Here's a snippet of my story. Baseball has been part of my life ever since I learned how to walk. I enjoyed playing other sports, but nothing compared to the love I had for baseball. Growing up, I spent most of my time playing, practicing, and watching baseball. It is a very challenging sport that also has hidden challenges that doesn't involve the sport itself. Baseball players often fall into the stereotype of chewing tobacco. Myself, personally fell into this stereotype. I began using chewing tobacco at the young age of 15 and immediately became hooked in less than a year. Chewing tobacco, also known as snuff or dip, became an everyday part of my life. I spent thousands of dollars a year throwing away money on a habit that I couldn't get rid of. I didn't see a problem with the habit when I was in high school, but once I got to college, I noticed that I couldn't go more than 30 minutes without the stuff. Whether I was on the baseball field, in class, driving my car, or even at the movies, I was being controlled by my habit. I knew I needed to stop because of the recent death of a professional baseball player due to chewing tobacco. I tried numerous ways to stop that included herbal chew, coffee pouches, and even prescription pills. However, nothing seemed to work for me. The longest I could go without the stuff was maybe a day or two, but even then the withdrawals of anger and anxiety would get the best of me. I was continuously struggling every day when others didn't understand why it was so hard. I wanted to get this burden off my back, but my mind and body didn't want me to. I knew that in the long run, it would harm me physically, but I didn't care because I didn't want to go through all the withdrawals that I had experienced numerous times. However, one day I read an article about a baseball player who was diagnosed with oral cancer because he started using tobacco at an early age. In the article, he talks about how there are so many more important things in life, and having a deformed jaw from continuous years of using tobacco wasn't worth the heartache for your family. From that day forward, which has been almost a year, I haven't let the substance get the best of me. I continue to struggle at times, but choosing to make a change that controlled my life for over 6 years is a blessing that I am truly grateful for.
Thanks, Connor, for sharing your story.
You have been listening to KSMC 89.5 Moraga. I'm Connor Hornsby.
I'm Linda Palma.
We've been your hosts.
Special thanks to Anna Angosta for producing this show, to Forrest Solis, our technical producer,
And a special thanks to the students in Cher Sabata's audio production course for helping make this show possible. Thank you for listening.